from the soil from wicking out into the cold, from, you know, or the cold wicking into the into your soil in the ground. I don't know the exact temperature that they're aiming for. I think it's about 45 in the soil. But the basic objective is to keep soil temperature above 45, ideally above 50, but at least above 45. And if you can do that, if you can't do that, then it's so cold that the soil biology has a hard time functioning, and that's going to be your limiting factor. So there, you need to have a certain basic soil temperature maintained. So doing what you can to keep it warm, it would be a crucial piece of the puzzle. John was just talking about a kelp. I can't remember what it's called, from the North Atlantic, I believe, that grows in very cold water and has all these, what's that?
Laminaria.
I thought you were going to leave us high and dry.
So, I think we're here from John in terms of nutrients for winter growing. I know for ourselves, there's a lot of commercial growers that have excessive levels of nitrates in the wintertime because of the low amount of sunlight. So for ourselves, one of the things that we're often doing is looking at Epsom salts as a foliar spray in February, at the same time that a lot of growers start to bring water back in to try and leach some of the nitrates out of the soil.
And the nitrates are high because?
From my experience, and somebody else can kind of, you know, follow up if this isn't what you think, but I think one of the things is that where we are, that soil hasn't really shut down entirely because the temperatures remain high, and as the daylight is shorter, we don't really have the same amount of rampant growth that can actually take up those nitrates that happen out, and then combined with the fact that you're not leaching anything out of the soil. So we would really try to make sure that you're balancing the nitrate availability, primarily so that you don't have to deal with aphids in that late February time that a lot of growers do.
I'm not sure I have any specific advice for you, Jeremy. I'm sorry.
Say that again? Oh, yeah. He will in 1 second. Let's hear from Carl.
Well, a lot of green plants have the capacity to store nitrate. If they don't have the energy to produce proteins with it, they can store the nitrate waiting. They are, well, I don't want to give up this nitrate opportunity, so I'm going to store it in tissue. I'm going to wait until there's enough energy in terms of day length and to make full protein. So if, for instance, you have spinach growing with very low light, relatively cold conditions, and you happen to have incorporated a bunch of pelletized chicken manure when you planted the spinach, you're very likely to have very elevated tissue nitrates, like 3,000 parts per million. I've bought at the organic winter spinach from Cal Organic and checked the nitrate and seen 3,000 parts per million at our co-op. And in some countries like Austria and Switzerland, they actually, it'd be illegal to sell that material. So a cautionary about the winter growing, if there's excess nitrate available and low, short day length, you're very likely to have it in your leaf tissue.
I don't see why, you know, being able to support and stimulate the photosynthetic capacity, which would help make more sugar, which would give more energy, would be a bad idea. So I'm not sure. Is there anything specific, John, you'd suggest for a fertility that's in cold temperatures separate from warm temperatures? Supporting the photosynthetic capacity, basically, you know, the trace elements that are critical, you know, maybe some magnesium, perhaps to support that. But I think functionally, the system has an optimum, you know, functional temperature somewhere around 70, and above that and below that, it works less well. But the same basic principles of water and mineral and biology are applicable across the board. From Paul and Sandy Arnold, I think, you know, I really took home the import of separating the outside soil from the inside soil with a thermal barrier, and maintaining that will help maintain soil temperature, which facilitates all the rest of the biological processes more well. 18 inches is probably fine. Right on the line. chickens peck at it, okay, put some wood, buffer it. Yeah, I think it only needs to go down to ground level. I mean, what you're trying to do is separate the inside ground from the outside ground. You don't want that cold wicking in to, you know, sap the heat out of your heat sink, which is your soil, because when that soil cools off, the whole system slows down and becomes less functional. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the same principle as from the crushed
out. Hay bales with old greenhouse plastic. That's what I've got around my house. That keeps my house warm. Certainly.
You mentioned earlier about the one interesting tomato spaced out more. I wonder if you would maybe dare to talk in general terms about plant spacing versus catalog requirements for suggestions.
I'd actually be curious to hear what John has to say about optimal spacing. You want to talk about it?
The question is about adequate plant spacing, or what are we actually doing versus catalog recommendations. So I've listened to Dan talk about this for a long time, and we are probably still addicted to high-density planting from the historical idea that you just plant as much as you can because some of it's going to fail. For a good example, let's say your cucumbers are squash, you put them at a foot apart in the row because at least before they fail, you get more fruit out of that plant. We are slowly spreading things out. So like this year, we went to eggplant, just single row to a bed instead of doing two rows to a bed. Certainly giving our cucurbits more space. We're going to go back. I've done tomatoes on 3-foot spacing versus 2-foot spacing. Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, to be honest with you, where we're at, so we're, you know, our target for next year will be about 15 pounds of marketable fruit on tomatoes. And that was, we put our tomatoes too close together in the beds as well. They're 4-foot, 5-foot beds. And we're sort of not land rich where we are, so we have to balance that. But I think anything that you're looking at that has the capacity to really put on long growing season, especially the cucurbits we're vining out and stuff like that, we know we certainly don't get the yields that we could be getting if we gave adequate spacing for our winter squash and things along those lines. The other thing that we run into to some degree, and you can argue, you know, maybe in a perfect world you wouldn't have this happen, but like with lettuce heads in the springtime, when we get these really big lettuce heads, you know, we actually are kind of oftentimes, if we're going to let them mature to a nice, big, gigantic lettuce head, we're going to give them adequate spacing. We're keep them on 12-inch spacing because otherwise they're, and we just shut that airflow down so completely, and we have a lot of humidity being close to the water, so. That's practically speaking what we do with it.
I would say brassicas in general, 3 feet, you know, cabbage and kale and collards and broccoli and stuff like that. Tomatoes, I think 5 feet is a good baseline. Peppers and eggplants, probably 3 feet, something on that order. You know, in reality, I don't know if anybody's got a good answer to that question, and the vigor of your seed and the, you know, the health of your transplant is going to determine what this appropriate spacing is. I think really, you know, the more we can all play around with this stuff and find a couple vigorous plants and give them a bunch of space and put a few more, you know, put these guys at 4 feet, these guys at 3 feet, these guys at 2 feet and watch them and learn. I don't know anybody who's laid out these metrics and parameters very well, and I'm playing around with it myself, certainly.
I think just one thing to add is when I was speaking with Amanda Cather at Waltham Fields at some point in the fall when she was at the craft variety discussion, one of the things that she said is, you know, for her CSA, they don't want to have gigantic cabbages, so they've actually been making sure they go back to tighter spacing because as they've been doing more with fertility work, or this past year she had cover crop plus compost plus fertilizer, and she said the cabbages were, you know, just too big. So certainly a lot of it also will be market dependent.
That's a good point. Okay, 15 pounds per acre manganese, we did that. Outline the total approach for true plant health systems that have worked in the past. If there is Roundup everywhere, what about DDT? Those are two separate questions. The total approach for true plant health systems that have worked in the past. I think that's what we've been doing for the last couple of days. Is there any specific question on that one? Somebody wrote that up recently. No? if there's Roundup everywhere, what about DDT? For me, that goes back to the whole conversation about biology in your soil. What John was saying about the Lubkes, it depends on the specific environmental conditions in your field, and that correlates all the way through to the quality of your crops. You know, the specific environmental conditions determine the actual value of the crops. It doesn't matter what your certification standard says you are, or what you think you label yourself as. It's what the functionalities of the system that determines the overall function. Yes? John said DDT today is only a fraction of what it was 30 years ago because it's been digested. So it happens. It takes time. In some situations it happens faster, other situations it happens slower. Plenty of organic crops still have DDT residue in them now. You know, in fields that had DDT applied 30, 40, 50 years ago, still have residues, and those fields having been converted to organic agriculture, poorly done, will pull that up into the plants and you can find the residue. So there's no real easy delineation. It has a lot to do with the functionality of the living system in the soil. How do you apply these principles to a really diverse, small, what was that, loaner operation?
Less than 10 acres.
Oh, less than 10 acres. 20 different spring regimens, fertilizing. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Did anybody specifically ask that? Are they still here?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I think John kind of pressed on that earlier when he was talking about his operation, where he sort of keeps the standard drench and foliar, and then maybe they add a few things as you need to do it. There's certainly, if you want to get into subtleties, energies that can push towards fruiting production or growth production, and you know, at some point you maybe want to think about that. In reality, for us on our farm, we often make that decision based on economics. When we're making our beds, you know, when we're thinking about mineral applications, if we want to do that, or if we're going to take the time and we're going to do a foliar spray and we're not going to cover the whole farm because it's the height of the season, we're often picking those crops which are going to have the biggest impact from us economically.
I see seawater rate. Is there somebody there with that? Seawater. Maynard Murray was one of the first people to actually do some research on this. Interesting fellow, well credentialed. Seawater has, I think, 90 or so different minerals in it. It is the naturally occurring material on the planet with the most broad spectrum mineral component. 96% of the minerals in seawater are sodium and chlorine, which is what we call salt generally, and it's the other 4% that have the real benefit. What I use is a product called C-Crop, which has basically precipitated out the sodium and the chlorine and has all the ultra trace elements in it. I think it's about 50 gallons of water makes 1 gallon of C-Crop. And I think it's 10 gallons of C-Crop per acre is the most you should use in a year, and you probably shouldn't do that much. So, 50, 200 gallons per acre of seawater would probably be a heavy dose. If you're just using seawater, you need to be very concerned about the sodium and the chlorine levels. I recommend you use, I think it's lye, basically, that you can use to precipitate out the sodium chloride and get the beneficial minerals without the heavy levels of sodium chloride. So precipitating that out, using in small quantities, I've been talking to people about this, and some people I've said, use 10 gallons per acre. And this guy had a 1,000 square foot garden, and he thought I said 10 gallons per 1,000 square feet. And he was putting on way more than I would ever say he should do. And he's like, this has been amazing. I love the sea. I'm telling everybody about seawater. I'm like, if you do that for too long, you're going to seriously imbalance your system. Slow and steady, small amounts are better. I think if you were to be planting and transplanting and you wanted to use something like 50 gallons of seawater per acre, that would be like a good heavy dose. And then I probably wouldn't use anywhere near that much for the rest of the year. But it's, the sodium and the chlorine are what you should be concerned about. And if you get rid of those, then you can be much more generous with it. Is that clear? Sufficient? Yes?
Do you apply by spray?
Drench spray. I always dilute it. You certainly don't put it on straight. Generally, whatever I'm putting on into the field, I suggest a 2% solution, which is a quarter cup of whatever you're using to a gallon of water. And if you do that, you don't ever need to worry about things burning. If you put seawater on straight, you're going to have a lot of dead plants. Yep. I believe they precipitate out. As salt. There are ways of doing this. I don't do it. I've read about it and I said, wow, that looks interesting for somebody. and proceed to go just buy the stuff that's I know is good and use that. Ormus is the term. It's referred to generally ORMUS Ormus State Minerals is what you're looking for. So if you're that kind of a person who likes to do chemistry projects, just look up Ormus online and you'll find various interesting websites and some recipes for how to make it.
So I want to skip over a couple of questions and ask John to come up. John, could you talk a little bit, and I know you mentioned it a little bit yesterday with pasture management, but there's two questions here. Please address improving hay fields and how to adapt recommendations to pasture land. So if maybe you could talk a little bit more in terms of relationships of timing of your cuts, what you're doing in terms of any applications, if you are doing applications.
Good. Thanks, Derek. So when we focus on putting together a complete system and a program for forages, whether we're talking about pastures or hay crops, the focal point is increasing photosynthetic activity. As the story that I referred to earlier, where we put on a foliar application on alfalfa and we're able to see the soil benefits, the soil effects of that 2.5 years later, those results were accomplished by working with photosynthesis. So to enhance forage health, looking at the two different toolboxes, you can enhance soil by working with soil biology, compost, mineral nutrition. Forages do a better job of releasing minerals from the soil and from applied products than just about any other crop. So if you have grass pastures or alfalfa, for example, you put limestone or rock phosphate onto that soil, they will break that up and make it available to other plants and future crops and release it into the soil system faster than if you have any other crop out there, because they have much more efficient root systems and much more efficient photosynthesis, especially the grasses having the C4 versus the C3 photosynthetic pathway, and they send a lot more sugars down into the root system. So you have that toolbox. The second toolbox, as I referred to yesterday, is the foliar applications, which we work with very heavily to help these plants get to a higher level of health faster. So what we will typically do is use a foliar application, which would contain a combination of materials such as the Photomag, PHT calcium, perhaps PHT phosphorus, and Rejuvenate. And put that on as a foliar. And we would also include MicroPack in that as well for trace mineral nutrition. And we will do that foliar first in the spring as soon as those plants begin greening up. And that application is very critical to make sure that we have completely formed proteins in that first cutting. And then we will reapply that about 10 days to 2 weeks after each cutting, when we have about 3 to 4 inches of regrowth. And when we have that 3 to 4 inches of regrowth, those plants are very open, they'll absorb that nutrition very quickly, and you'll get very high quality growth and a very strong growth response for the next cutting. So when we're producing hay, we will put on an application typically 10 days after each cutting on average. For forage production on grazing dairies, and when we're grazing, instead of going after every grazing, we will typically do every 35 to 40 days. And a foliar application every 35 to 40 days, or after each grazing, if our grazing period is about that time frame. So that's kind of it in a nutshell of what we do on the forages.
How much?
The right amount. question was on how much of the right applications. Typically, we're doing about 4 quarts per acre of Photomag, 4 to 6 quarts per acre, and about 1 quart per acre of Micropac, and about 2 quarts per acre of the PHT phosphorus. I would only add calcium above and beyond that if you also have a severe calcium shortage, and perhaps 2 quarts of Rejuvenate.
These are your products?
These are all our products, yes. What would be the approximate cost per acre of that treatment? I would say about $25, right in the neighborhood of $25 per acre per foliar application. And with today's hay prices, it doesn't take a lot of hay to get that back, just in terms of quantity without even addressing the increases that you'll see in quality. You'll get that response several times over. Yes.
The related question, John, yesterday you talked about the soil system had improved. And I'm curious about a couple things. How much, the degree to which that's an analogy, and the degree to which would you take that literally? And,
all right, so the question was, when we refer to the soil plant system and referring to the soil as the plant's digestive system, using the analogy of an animal rumen, how literally do I take that analogy? I take it very literally, as in 100% equivalent. When I say, okay, so I take it as 100% equivalent in function. Not necessarily the exact same microbial species. There certainly are different microbial species, but in terms of function and how those functions compare, 100% equivalent. No differences.
So then, so feeding cows, or sheep or goats, I guess, you know, which one's better than the other? Am I right then considering that you're also then removing those minerals in some of the more bioavailable form that you just spread this out?
So the question is, if we were then to feed trace minerals directly to ruminant animals, and if those nutrients transfer through in the manure, would those nutrients be more bioavailable than if they were directly applied? And for a lot of the materials, the answer to that question would be yes. Those nutrients, when they come through the manure, will be more bioavailable, there will be more plant available than nutrients that would be applied directly to the soil. However, I would say that is a very expensive way to remineralize your land. You can get a lot more of a response if you have deficiencies of nutrients. Rather than trying to feed them to your livestock were not designed to eat minerals out of a bag. Take that same mineral nutrition, if they need boron, for example, and put that on as a foliar spray onto your plants. And your plants will absorb it and build it into their own plant structure. Now it will be much more bioavailable to the cow or to the animal than if it gets it out of a bag. So the flip side of that coin is that less of it will be sent through in the manure. But what will really happen when you apply that to the crop, you have much greater levels of sugar content and quality in the crop. So you're getting a lot more than just the mineral through the crop instead of the mineral from a bag. Okay, what was the next question, Derek?
I think just maybe take a few more.
Go ahead. Very good question. So the question was, in the foliar application that I would put together on forages and pastures, would that also work on a cover crop? Yes, it would. It would work very well. And our intention is primarily to increase the photosynthetic rate. And that specific application does that very, very well. So when we look at photosynthesis, there's a couple of different things that we can look at. But the core of photosynthesis is obviously based in chlorophyll. So the more chlorophyll content we have in a leaf, the more sunlight energy that leaf can intercept, the more sugar it's going to produce. So what is chlorophyll? When we look at the center of the chlorophyll molecule, the center of the chlorophyll molecule is a single magnesium ion surrounded with 4 nitrogens. So This is why when conventional farmers put on an application of nitrogen, the crops become green and they green up very quickly. It's because they have an increased chlorophyll content thanks to the nitrogen. You can do the exact same thing by applying magnesium, and now you don't have the large levels of free nitrates. So you increase the chlorophyll content in the plant and you increase that plant's sugar production. So phosphorus also has a very strong connection to photosynthesis. Phosphorus is not so much directly connected in energy production as it is in energy transfer. So if we were to use an analogy that I've used before, inside the cell we have this engine that is driving the cell, and this engine is called the mitochondria. The fuel that the engine is burning is glucose. It's the sugar produced during photosynthesis. However, that engine can run, it can have a lot of horsepower, and it can run at very high RPMs, but if it's not connected to the machinery of the cell, that horsepower is going to be completely wasted. The energy transfer system, the belt, if you will, that connects the engine to the machinery in the cell is phosphorus, specifically adenosine triphosphate, adenosine diphosphate, the Krebs or the Kelvin cycle. So think of phosphorus as energy transfer. So for the purposes of putting together a foliar spray to really increase photosynthesis, we need to address magnesium, we need to address phosphorus, we need to address trace minerals. And that is the reason I selected those four materials, to provide a broad spectrum of trace minerals, to provide magnesium, to provide phosphorus, and also to provide the trace minerals that really enhance protein synthesis in the case of the Photomag. That was the rationale for putting that formulation together. Yes, Tim? Okay, so the question comment was, the understanding is that calcium cannot get past the leaf, and has that changed? So calcium in the ionic form is, there's two different types of transport tissue inside the plant. You have both xylem and phloem tissue. And calcium, when it is in the ionic form, can only be absorbed by the plant root system and transported through the root system up into the upper parts of the plant. However, when calcium is in the form of microbial metabolites, or if it is applied as a foliar application and it is bonded with organic and amino acids, as the PHT calcium would be, it can then be, the plant doesn't recognize it purely as calcium. It's now part of a molecule, a macromolecule. So it will move it around inside the plant wherever it needs it. Yep, good. Yes?
Yesterday we talked about nitrates into the rhizosphere. You mentioned the figure 70% of photosynthate moving from the plant body down to the plant roots.
Yes.
I have heard of the number 20% of photosynthate.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, it's not just photosynthate, but secondary compounds of phenols. And my question is,
okay, so there's a couple of questions here. The first are that what level of plant photosynthates are actually being transferred into the root system, and what forms of compounds, what various forms of compounds are they are being transferred down there. So I quoted the number that 70% of total plant sugar production is transferred down to the root system. That is the number used by quoted by Horst Marschner in his book Mineral Nutrition in Higher Plants, which is the official standard university textbook to teach plant nutrition. So you can find that number in that book, Horst Marschner, Mineral Nutrition in Higher Plants. And quite honestly, the number, you quoted the number of that, another author stated that 20% of the total plant photosynthates are transferred down to the root system. I absolutely believe that number to be correct. The level of plant sugars sent down to the root system is directly related to the level of that plant's health. So if that plant is struggling for energy and it barely has enough energy to keep itself going, it's not going to send a lot of sugars down to the root system. It needs all of them for itself. But as the energy increases, and has more energy, it'll start sending a lot more sugars down the root system to where it reaches level 3, level 4 of plant health. 70% of total photosynthates are going down into the root system. So What form are those photosynthates in that go down to the root system and those root exudates? They are in the form of organic acids, amino acids, and essential fatty acids, and also some of the plant secondary metabolites. As you referred to the phenolic compounds, these aromatic compounds, the plant will begin sending those down into the root system as well. And when it begins, when it has enough energy and it begins sending lipids and phenolic compounds down to the root system, those lipids provide the foundation for building stable humic substances. As long as plants are low in energy, they're primarily sending sugars and amino acids. And those sugars and amino acids will be digested and metabolized by bacteria, released back into the soil system for digestion by plants. They will not build organic matter. But as the fat exudates increase, now you start building organic matter in the system, and now you really get the system functioning in what I term carbon induction. Do I think invasive plants are bad? Well, what defines an invasive plant? What defines a weed? Simply a plant that is growing somewhere where we don't want it. Who says that we, in our wisdom, are entitled to make the decision?
There's a second question here, John, that I'd like to hear your response to, which is, can you explain how John's insoluble products end up in roots, end up on roots in a water-based drench? I think that should be pretty easy, straightforward, but can you explain how those products, the insoluble but available, end up presumably in the roots on a water-based drench? So basically we're going to the opposite. You just talked about
how. I talked about it in leaves.
Oh, no, I was thinking you just spoke to how these plants are sending nutrition to the roots, right. And you talk about the opposite.
So when a material, and by the way, I should mention that it's not my idea, it's not a new idea that fertilizers should be available but not soluble. William Albrecht quoted that in the mid to late 1940s, that for plants to be really healthy, fertilizers should be available but not soluble. So I certainly don't take credit for that idea. So in our materials that are not water soluble, what really happens is you put them into the soil system. And when the soil digestive system is working, obviously the root system has limited surface area. So if you're not dependent on ionic water movement or on water movement carrying ions to the roots, which by the way, stop and think about that for just a moment. And think of the sense or the lack thereof in water movement carrying nutrients to roots. So what this is trying to describe is that we have a plant. And early on in that plant's life, it is still very small, 6 to 8 inches. We have, for discussion's sake, we have very low water requirements from that plant at that stage. And typically, early in the spring, we have very high levels of soil moisture, more than adequate levels of soil moisture. So what this is describing is essentially saying that we have the plant absorbing so much water that water is moving through the soil, carrying nutrients with it to the root zone, and then the roots are absorbing it and taking it to the upper part of the plant. When you look at the mathematical calculations of what that really would look like, it doesn't make any sense at all. But that's another discussion. So the question of how our materials are absorbed is really, you have this root system which has limited surface area. But when you have that root system combined with soil biology, especially fungi, also bacteria, say mycorrhizal fungi as an example, the surface area of that root system can increase, according to the soil microbiologist, by a factor of as much as 200 times. You have a tremendous fungal biomass, tremendous bacterial mass out into that soil, and they absorb those materials that are being applied, that we have applied, or other soil nutrients, and transfer them back to the plant along very clearly defined channels. Very similarly to what I discussed yesterday in these materials not being soluble, but putting them onto the leaf surface and how they are then converted by bacteria and fungi and made available to the plants through that digestive system. That's really how it functions.
Why don't we open it up to some more questions?
What about the trench?
The question is, in our drench, we had molasses or sugar on our ingredient list. I mean, it's all dependent on a couple of things, and we started doing sugars in our drenches partially because we were doing a lot of work into our fields. We didn't talk at length about the history of our fields, but they were conventional corn silage for about 20 plus years without any cover crop and sort of neglected. So we sort of felt like there wasn't going to be a lot of feed for microbes in those fields. So partially we're just, if we're building populations, we wanted to sustain it. I think, you know, almost any simple sugar is going to give you a response. So I'm not going to say one or the other is going to be better than that. And I know a lot of growers don't bother with the sugar, but we see like it makes a difference.
My comment on that would be that sugars are primarily a bacterial stimulant. So if you, it is possible to overdo sugar, and I have seen this happen in a couple of situations where farmers are applying applying sugar very frequently, as in every week in significant quantities, and I don't know what the quantities were that Derek was talking about, but I personally favor the use of molasses rather than other simple carbohydrates for one very simple reason, in that the molasses has a much higher mineral and trace mineral content. Question is, what do I see when molasses or sugars are overdone? And basically what we see happening is that we can actually, if it's done regularly, week after week after week, constantly, we can get tremendous bacterial overgrowth that can actually tie up calcium and some other nutrients and prevent it from being available to the plant, only because the nutrients aren't cycling, only because the bacterial population isn't dying off, if you will. Yes.
I did that last.
So you've seen it.
Well, I haven't seen it. I was using your liquid mineral products as well, because the soil is dead, trying to get bacterial life in there. I suspect I was just trickle feeding with foliars and branches.
To give folks a sense, I think we probably end up buying something like 5 gallons of molasses a year for our 5 acres that we're working. And they end up in some drenches, they end up in some foliar sprays, we do it some crop residue digestion, it sort of just depends. And in some years we don't use as much, and I think last year we still have half that sitting in the basement.
You're not within the danger zone. I was what I was referring to, I've seen farmers put on as much as a gallon to 2 gallons of molasses per acre per week through the irrigation system, so that doesn't work. Well, I would love to have the price differential on that one.
Yeah, we've been trying to sell that to our CSA members, as I talked about yesterday with our deep nutrition share, and you know they're not really going for a $1,200 CSA share right now. So, but if you have your own maple syrup, maybe.
The sap itself does well. It's going to ferment, obviously, before you apply it. Before you can't really save the sap, but we actually do have a couple of farms in Ohio that are collecting the steam, the distillation, when they are evaporating the maple sap, and they have tested it, and they find that the distillate has a very high silicon content. And the silicon content, I forget the exact number, but I want to say it was something like 300 parts per million. It was much higher than I would have expected it to be. And they are actually using it as a tonic for people with some very interesting, very good responses. So would it have a positive impact on soils? I'm assuming it probably would. I don't know of anyone that has tried it. So the question was, I guess to restate it in my own words, is do mineral amendments and differences in soil fertility really have an impact in weed populations and weed profiles? Is that correct? Yes. So every plant has a very specific function, a very specific purpose to fulfill in life, just as every one of us does. And different plants are adapted to different soil types, and different plants have different nutritional requirements to fit different soil types. So we recognize as a common principle that alfalfa has different nutritional requirements from blueberries, which have different nutritional requirements from tomatoes, which have different nutritional requirements from cranberries. And much the same holds true of weeds. Weeds will grow in specific soil niche environments. So what we see happening is that as many of the weeds are what could be termed pioneering species. They are there to pioneer on soils that have become eroded, that are in many cases oxidized because we have a lot of tillage. As soon as those soils remain fairly stable on no-till farming, for example, I'm not a fan of no-till farming, I'm not here espousing that, but they do see weed populations significantly shift very quickly away from the lamb's quarter, the redwood pigweed, for example, that are would be more common pioneering species when soils are tilled. And these pioneering species that grow when soils are tilled are primarily growing because the soil has become oxidized because of exposure to oxygen. So as that soil environment shifts in terms of mineral structure, in terms of soil biology, in terms of organic matter, you will see weed populations shift and change, and the weeds, the plants that we define as weeds in our discretionary decision-making process that we define as weeds, become, they have a lower level of energy because they are not adapted specifically to that soil.
Yes. Do you have any remedy for mold?
In do I have any remedy for mold in-house?
Yeah.
Actually, I do. So the question was on treatments for molds in living spaces, which are becoming a very severe problem. And the only method that I know of that is effective long-term and actually works and is actually good for you is volatilizing or vaporizing essential oils, such as tea tree oil, cinnamon oil will do it. There's different essential oil combinations out there. A very good website that is out there is titled moldmisery.com. Moldmisery.com, and they actually offer several different essential oil combinations that have been proven to be very effective, as well as the vaporizers themselves. Okay, so the question is really, where does fish fit, liquid fish fit into the overall system? Well, let me put it this way. I've used a lot of liquid fish. I've recommended a lot of people to use liquid fish, and for the last 3 years, really, last 2 years, we have completely eliminated liquid fish from our system. And the question is, why? Why have we done that? It's not that I'm opposed to liquid fish. I don't think it's a bad idea. I think there are some bad quality fish sources out there, but that's my own opinion. But basically, what we have found is, I begin asking the question, is what can fish do for us that something else isn't already doing better? In terms of providing trace mineral nutrition, definitely the seaweeds and the liquid sea minerals are far outperforming the fish in terms of responses and results. And when we want to talk about increasing phosphorus nutrition, our micronized phosphorus can far outperform fish. When we want to talk about biological stimulation, rejuvenate and the sea crop with all the enzymes that they contain far outperform the liquid fish. So it's not that I'm opposed to liquid fish, but liquid fish, I don't see liquid fish bringing any value to our system that we can't improve upon with the tools that we already have. So it's not a bad material. A lot of people are using it, but a lot of people are using it less and less in our system. Let's put it this way. We used to use at AEA, we went through liquid fish by the semi-tanker truckload, and more than one or two of them. And a lot of our customers were using liquid fish until 2 years ago we started doing a lot of trials, putting the fish into the program and leaving the fish out of the program. And there was no difference, time and time again. So we took the fish out. As if you want to use the fish, and if you have a drum and a half left over, the best place to use it would be in a foliar application at about a quart to 2 quarts per acre. At about 10 to 14 days after cutting, when you have 3 to 4 inches of regrowth on forages. Yes, you can blend it right in with everything else. It'll be fine.
Do I have to stand here?
Yeah, sure you do.
Thanks. Completely, my name is Mike Bald from Vermont. Completely support and endorse everything spoken about weeds, but I heard some questions, so I thought I would just say. I do non-chemical weed control in central Vermont. That's where I'm coming from on the answer to this question. But what is a weed? There's 100 definitions. I have my own. I don't know if Charlotte's here from NRCS or not. A common definition of a weed is something that causes economic or ecological harm to the setting, to the landscape, to the scenario. So just keep that as a good rough. But I would ask you to certainly differentiate between native and non-native species of weeds, because the most important thing to keep in mind there is whether it's giant hogweed or oriental bittersweet or wild chervil, wild parsnip. There's dozens of them and more coming in every year, Japanese stiltgrass. They don't tend to come, they didn't arrive in this country or in this state or in this region with their host of predators or the relationship, the assortment, that very complicated web of other organisms that keep them in check. So they tend to just run rampant. And that's not true everywhere. Certainly there are other factors, but just be aware that your non-natives are the ones that are probably going to cause you difficulty. I don't do a lot of weed work in cultivated spaces because I've never tried to tell organic farmers what to do. I know better than that. But right, they do. Their cultivated spaces stay under control, and that's all good. It's the edges where you get the non-native plants in there you really need to worry and think about. They change soil type. They change soil chemistry. These plants, they can be harmful to people on the skin and so forth. So I just wanted to make that point, native versus non-native. A second point, in Vermont last year, 2012, you could not get funding from state agencies to do weed control in the organic spirit. If you were going to do weed control in Vermont, you had to use chemicals if you wanted grant support. 2011, I did two projects completely manual, pulling 1,700 honeysuckle off a hillside. That option was no longer available to that landowner in 2012. She had to go chemical. That was the state policy. I've asked about it in New Hampshire. I've asked about it in Massachusetts. It's kind of different per state. I believe, at least they told me, in Vermont this year, 2013, is going to go to, yeah, we'll accommodate, we'll fund people to do non-chemical approaches, but just in a very early detection scenario where the populations are small. I've taken a lot of time. I thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks. So I appreciate the comments very much. I do want to put out one additional thought, though, as a food for thought on the comments that were shared with native versus non-native plants. I do share the concerns, and I think the bigger picture perspective is that in reality, I don't think we have ever been successful. Well, no, I'll take that back. We have very seldom been successful in completely eradicating the non-native species from our environments and from our ecosystems. So we should also consider how we can utilize them and how we can build on their strengths that they bring to us. Because when you think about the many crops that we grow, think of all the animals that we have that were imported that are not native. Honeybees are not native. So for myself, I don't think that not being native is necessarily a problem in and of itself. Some of the plants that are not native can be a problem, and I do agree with that. So yes. Yes. Okay, so the comment question is on I can't think of the right term that you used, the opportunistic ability of these seeds and their ability to travel through compost. Essentially, I think there's two really good ways of removing weed seeds from the overall system. The first, specific to compost, is that when you have true compost digestion, fungal digestion, and the compost is really finished, bacteria in compost will not digest seeds. When you have fungal digestion happening in compost, they will digest weed seeds. And it has nothing to do with the temperature or the heat in the compost. The second point would be that the most effective cleanup crew for weed seeds in a soil profile is earthworms. They will feed on weed seeds at a rate that is almost unbelievable. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but high earthworm populations can clean up a weed bank in soil. That has been documented very well. Yes?
I just want to mention a story of the Arnolds. You were there. They had a problem. Paul and Sandy Arnold were sharing a story, which I think we all found really interesting, of his pea seeds, when he planted them, disappearing. So one time, the next day, or after a couple of days, he made a third trough, and he planted his seeds, didn't cover them up, but came out with a flashlight, and he found an enormous population of earthworms coming and stealing them and pulling them underground.
Very, very true. And this is unfortunate, but we have had commercial onion growers where they plant small onion transplants, literally go out there and spray diazinon to kill the earthworms, because the earthworms were pulling up all the onion transplants that they had transplanted and pulling them underground and feeding on them. So the question was what to do, and the response was eat earthworms. I think we underestimate our earthworm populations in a lot of ways. I wish I could recall the resource of where I read the original earthworm research on their seed digestive capacities, and I can't think of it right now, which is unusual for me, but most times, if I recall correctly, I want to say that they determined that if you have 100 earthworms, a combination of both night crawlers and redworms, per cubic foot of topsoil, or in that 1 foot column of soil, that you could reduce a seed bank of 220,000 weed seeds in the top 6 inches down to 15,000 weed seeds in 1.5 years, 18 months. So that's down to 5% of the original population. It's pretty profound.
I just mentioned something from kind of a practical standpoint on that. We certainly don't keep a weed-free farm as much as we endeavor to. This past year we had one of our onion crops was pretty overrun with weeds, and I had remembered some research that had talked about birds doing a better job of foraging weed seeds if you can just mow them and leave the seeds on the surface during the wintertime. So we decided, it was mid-September, about the same time we were putting down our tomato cover crop, and we decided rather than tilling that onion patch in, we just would mow it and leave it on the surface of the soil. And so with the thought that the birds would maybe eat those seeds. Interestingly enough, we didn't necessarily clear out that onion patch. I think we had some white mini onions that we never harvested because it was in the busy of the heart of the season, and we're focused on bigger onions or something like that. And as we were coming through and doing a field walk, probably in November, I think it was, there were mushrooms actually in reproductive form that had come up, presumably from some of the inoculants we were using in those onion patches. And so it was a reminder to me that we had actually made that decision not to till because we wanted to not kill those weed seeds, but in fact what we're also doing is probably being doing a better job of keeping that mycological population intact. So for me, that's sort of a, you know, it's, we do a heck of a lot of tillage, but every once in a while we put the brakes on.
Question is, do I have any suggestions for bringing back native warm season grasses with nutrition and management? I honestly do not. I can't really comment on that. I don't have a good idea. No. We had another question here.
Yeah, sorry about this. I was hoping you could define that mineral pre-plant and digestion spray, and I'm also wondering if there is specific recommendations in regards to foliar feeds or any other considerations when it comes to growing medicinal herbs.
You want to talk about that?
The first couple things were Derek's, and I think you should take the heart of the matter.
So a mineral pre-plant is probably referring to, that's probably looking at the fertilizer costs and that plant. So that's exactly what Dan was talking about earlier. It's that pre-plant that's a starter fertilizer or something like that. For foliar sprays, I mean, there's a zillion types of foliar sprays that one can get involved with. And so a takeaway, if you've never done foliar sprays and you're interested, go purchase a backpack sprayer or something that will do that work for you. And really simple recipe for us initially was we were just starting with fish because it was something that was easily available. We didn't have to combine a lot of ingredients, so on and so forth. And just doing nothing but fish, I think the first year we're doing sprays. So you can get more nuanced than that. And I think obviously John's talked a little bit about some of those recipes focusing on photosynthesis. And digestive sprays we talked about briefly earlier, but it's this, the same idea except that we're really focusing on what we're putting into that spray that will help the microbial population really do a good job with digestion. So for us, that's also looking at making sure we have phosphorus, because if you have a big flush of biology, they're going to need phosphorus to be able to keep them going, energetically speaking.
But you're putting molasses down digesting inoculant.
The full digestion spray that we use on the farm right now is fish fertilizer. I think it's probably about 2 gallons to the acre, probably a quart of molasses, some sort of biological inoculant, sometimes more than one, oftentimes some sort of enzymatic stimulant, and a little bit of molasses and some sea minerals.
And phosphorus, you said.
And phosphorus.
rapid solanasing, have you had any experience with that? Have you tried it out compared to standard tomato plant versus grafting?
Well, I think if you want to talk tomato grafting, and there's probably some folks in the room besides Skip especially, is obviously well-versed in that. So if you want to raise your hand, you know, go find Skip. He vends a lot of grafted tomato plants to folks in the Northeast. I do have an anecdotal experience, which is Steve Wallach, who runs the Friends Academy Garden, which I mentioned. They ran some experiments last year with grafted tomato plants through the URI extension, kind of their tomato plant sale. And he kept very detailed records of striped Germans that were grafted and non-grafted, put in the exact same soil, and his yield was about double on those grafted plants. So we're not doing any grafting on our farm, but you know, if you're going to cut out the number of tomato plants and you want a more vigorous root system, it might make sense.
I personally have no experience with grafting tomato plants. No comment from John? No experience or no comment? No comment. What's that? It's the same thing you're doing with apples and pears and things like that. I think I
I mean, at the heart of it, what you're doing is you're taking it at a critical growth stage, but you're giving itself a root system. I mean, and Steve spoke of that root system when he pulled those plants up. He says there was no comparison between the root systems. The root system of that grafted plant was just far superior to what the non-grafted was. So,
in an ideal world, I don't think grafting should be needed. And I think the reason we are getting a strong grafting response is because our genetics and our genetic potential has degraded on some of these varieties due to increased hybridization efforts and all of those inbreeding, all those good things. So the question becomes is why is the rootstock variety have such a much stronger root system than the variety that we're using to try to produce a fruit? And there's obviously different explanations for that, different reasons behind that, but at the end of the day, I am of the persuasion that for most crops, annual crops especially, if we grow them over several generations, save our own seeds, and produce high quality seed, plant them into healthy soils, you should not see a strong difference between grafted and non-grafted plants. I've seen this a little bit with not so much on the solanaceous crops, but on grafted watermelon, grafted onto gourd rootstock, which is becoming quite common down in Georgia. And when we worked with a farm for 3 years, and the first year there was no difference, there was a significant difference, as Derek was mentioning, on the grafted versus non-grafted plants. Second year there was still a difference, but not nearly as strong. The third year we had cut the original difference in half. So we had reduced the differentiation between the grafted and non-grafted by a significant factor simply by increasing the health of the non-grafted variety.
And I think there's this, the plant breeding aspect. John Navazio was interviewed in Acres this winter, and you know, one of the things that he stressed also with open pollinateds, which we sometimes hold up as being these great things, is that a lot of the seed houses haven't been putting energy into actually keeping those open pollinated varieties strong and vigorous. So he's actually, you know, kind of highlighting that, you know, back in the day, you know, when he was first talking to folks, there were people that would go to this seed house or that house specifically to seek out their strain of an open pollinated variety. So I think that's one of the things, and this could be maybe a segue to a wrap-up question. For me, one of the things I'm really kind of excited about when I think about the future is just the sheer number of folks that are starting to get excited about this and the thought lines that, you know, those that, which was just spoken to, which is, you know, if we have that sort of effort on any level in traditional plant breeding that gives commercial growers that aren't necessarily saving all their seeds the opportunity to have access to that better genetics, we could really, you know, not only increase our bottom lines, but start to see a lot healthier response. I want to be mindful of our time, and I thought maybe this would be a good chance to just kind of open up with final thoughts and comments from the past 2 days. Is that worth?
One last question?
I did have a question, I'm sorry.
It was a good try.
Yes.
Grafting made me think of pruning, and I wanted to ask you about pruning apple trees, if you have a position on how to prune apple trees.
The question is, do I have a position on pruning apple trees? And I have a very controversial position, so I'm very hesitant to state it.
Oh, no, I'd like to hear it. Thank you.
We like
that. Well, I was originally exposed to the philosophy of a Japanese doctor, One Straw Farming. So he basically wrote that when plants have the proper nutrition and they are allowed to grow and build their own frame naturally from the beginning, they do not need to be pruned. And so I have begun experimenting with this, and I've also sought anecdotal evidence, and I believe that I have found very strong anecdotal evidence that healthy trees do not need to be pruned, but also that the converse of that is once a tree has been pruned, it will need to continue to be pruned for the rest of its lifetime. And this applies also to grafting. Grafted trees will always have to be pruned. Non-grafted trees should not need to be pruned. So the anecdotal evidence that I found really interesting was actually from my father. When My father was in his mid-teens. He actually was the head of a harvesting crew at a local orchard about 20 miles away from where I grew up. And they had about 50 acres of apple trees, some pear trees, cherries, peaches, and so forth. They had a very well-diversified orchard. But in one corner, this orchard had been in the family for four generations. And in one corner of the orchard, there were 5 acres of apple trees that were 160 years old when he was working there. And he described these apple trees. He said these apple trees were 32 to 36 inches across at the base, and they grew up to about 4 to 4.5 foot level, and then they had branches that were 18 to 24 inches in diameter, and they extended out from the trunk 20 to 24 feet. He said that the branch would go out, kind of go gradual uphill, then dip down as its weight accumulated, and then it would go back up again. 20 to 24 feet. Those trees were never pruned, ever. And he said they harvested in an average year, they harvested anywhere from 40 to 50 bushels of apples per tree on those trees. So those were trees that were never pruned, that were 150 years old, that was standard tree size before there was any grafting. So that's my answer to that question.
Derek was suggesting we close up. Is these critical questions? I feel like the energy is getting tired. It's been a couple of long and full days. I guess I'm the first one concluding. Thank you all for coming. I hope it's been a valuable experience. Hope you've learned and understood and met good people, hopefully new friends and collaborators. I guess I'd like to just give a quick outline of what we're intending to do tomorrow. I know we're expecting a smaller audience, probably 25 or 30 people, maybe 35. And the objective...
No, you're expecting all of them to stay here.
No, I wasn't actually. As soon as you're out, most of them are gone, John. They know when the action leaves. Basically, you know, as far as, you know, the last couple of days have been, here's hopefully some valuable how-tos and some principles and theories. And then tomorrow is really a conversation about where are the holes, you know, what do we need to learn more, and how do we bring this forward systemically and strategically. So I look forward to a smaller group conversation where we can really get a chance to talk more to each other specifically, and those people who are find this all this work inspiring and energizing can get a chance to, you know, put together some, you know, build relationships and move forward in the coming year with action. So if that's sufficiently vague, hopefully it's sufficiently intriguing as well. And those of you who are planning on coming are already planning on coming, but thank you all. And yes, I'll move on to Derek, I guess.
I just want to really thank the other folks for presenting, and to encourage you, there's a tremendous amount of learning to be done this coming growing season. I'm going to do another course for Dan this coming spring, so if you haven't done a course with the BFA and you're interested, those dates are going to be Saturday, March 9th and Saturday, April 13th. It'll be in the greater Plymouth area. I know for people that might be interested, there's a workshop at Rhode Island next weekend on the 10th that's going to be led by David. He actually took off already, but David Fisher of Natural Roots. So if people want to get a chance to get in depth on some of the cover cropping methods that David uses, he's got a really inspirational farm, and you can look on the website for NOFA Rhode Island for that. So there's a lot of great opportunities. Certainly hope to see folks at upcoming NOFA events. If you're a BFA member and you're not a NOFA member, would really just not even twist your arm, but tell you that it's important for you to become a NOFA member. And I'm on the NOFA board, of course. And vice versa, if you're a NOFA member and you're not currently a member of the BFA, I'd just like to encourage you to think about coming out and supporting the BFA.
Good. Well, I would want to thank all of you for being here the last couple of days, taking the time and the energy out of your schedule to learn what you can. And for all of us now, we need to continue learning, but take home what we've learned and apply what we have learned. So I'd like to encourage you in that, and also just leave you with one thought. With all of the things, I hope I've shared some of the things that are really wrong with agriculture today, and I hope I've also shared some of the opportunities and the potential that we have had, that we have to make a difference and to have an impact. So I would encourage you, if you can, to also share that message with your friends, with your neighbors, and next year for the next Soil and Nutrition Conference, please bring two more people that haven't been here before.
All right, thank you.